the blade thrums and crackles with threads of blue energy, an electro sigh.
She regards those bound before her with golden eyes. These people are frightened of what is happening. Good. They should be. Now it is time to soothe their fear. A balm to salve the sting. The vocoder mutates your voice as she speaks. Your words are loud and alive, vibrating with a deep intensity. The voice that emerges is velvety and rich, and Eliodi can feel it all the way down at the ends of your fingertips. She hopes they can, too.
I am Eliodi Maracavagna, child of Darshadal, and captain of the Superstar Destroyer Annihilator.
Though here, she pauses and looks up to the ceiling as if reconsidering.
I don't anticipate keeping that name, the Annihilator. Too final. Too murdery. Not really my flavor.
The pirate's hand fritters in the air like a fluttering moth.
As such, you may relax. If none of you try to kill me today, I will kill none of you. Such is our bargain. I will be taking your ship to join my fleet. Our sovereignty requires vessels like this, and the cargo it carries. But I am no murderer, and certainly no slaver. And so you are free to step to the nearest escape pod and begone.
Vinthar steps in the front and thrusts a claw-tipped finger in the air.
But,
he announces.
But,
Eliodi continues.
While I will not press any of you into service, I will make the offer. Join me. Come aboard our stolen destroyer. Live the life of a pirate. Enjoy a life of spoils and riches. Be greedy. Be self-interested. Life is far too short for all this.
She makes a sour face.
New Republic nonsense. Do you really believe your precious foundling government will save the galaxy? Please. I think not. I am a precious realist. What you get in this lifetime is purely the result of what you take. Come with me. Come to my nation. Become part of my fleet. Join my sovereign space. Enjoy the freedom that comes with taking whatever you want, whatever you can get, whenever the chance. Anyone? Anyone at all?
Someone will take the offer. Someone always takes the offer. This time, the taker surprises Eliodi. There, against the wall, is a young woman. A girl, really. Plain as dirt. Plain as space. Nothing exceptional but for the fire in her eyes. She stands up, pulling away from a woman who Eliodi suspects is the girl's mother, or at least her guardian. The woman cries out,
Contessa, sit down!
I hate Chandrilla!
The girl snaps. Her voice shakes, but there's metal in there. It warms Eliodi. The confidence. The selfishness. Good.
It's dull. I want adventure. I want a life. I don't want to be cloistered anymore.
Yes, girl. That's it. Be who you want to be.
Eliodi's growing pirate kingdom out there in wild space is all about the sovereignty of the self. The woman pleads, of course.
No, Contessa!
But Eliodi shushes the woman.
Let her be, woman. Are you her mother?
Reluctantly, with spite shining in her eyes, the woman nods.
Yes.
The girl has made a decision. Respect it.
The woman swallows.
Then I will come too.
Mom,
Cartessa says. Eliodi pulls the girl close.
Let her come. But she will govern you no more, Katessa. The mother will find her way, and the daughter will find hers. Anyone else?
No takers.
Anyone at all?
Fine. Eliodi grins and says,
Then enjoy your intrepid escape pod journey, one and all. Thank you for the ship and your supplies. I have been Eliodi Morakavanya. It has been your pleasure.
With a flourish of the cape, she turns and heads back through the airlock. The girl, Kartessa, follows close behind. A small smile tugs at her cheeks, even as her mother weeps. Eliodi's own empire grows once more.
Chapter 9. As the sunrise burns the edge of the Silver Sea, the team shuffles one by one into the belly of the Halo, gathering in the main hold. Jazz comes up last. Everyone is talking. Temin mumbling about how he doesn't want to miss X-Wing practice. Jom chastising the boy because it's called training and not practice. Sinjir saying something about how he forgot to grab that bottle of Ciraki, and hey, does anyone have an extra bottle of Ciraki? Because Ciraki, that's why. It's all background noise to the bounty hunter. The noise in the foreground is the static of her own thoughts, crackling and snapping right at the front of her mind. Her skin tingles with an unusual kind of anxiety, one she's not used to, one that is born of a division inside her. A fissure she cannot seem to close. An injury that won't heal. At her core, Jazz feels like two different people. She has always told herself that everything she does is for her own self. I am not here to make friends, being an oft-repeated phrase anytime some weapons trader or bartender or client wants to do more than talk about the business at hand. That's the line she drops in their laps. Not friends. Don't need them. Sorry, thank you, goodbye. And she's never had much of a cause to carry, either. The only purpose she possesses is to pay her debts. Debts that actually aren't really her own at all, are they? They're her aunt's. Sugi's.
Damn you, Sugi.
Jazz loved her aunt. Loved her more than words can say. And all the while she'd watch the woman fritter away her contracts. She'd bail on jobs if they violated her honor. Or she'd do them her own way and burn the client in the process. Or she'd side with her team. Or she'd take on rinky-dink low-pay or no-pay work to protect some new group of underdogs or slaves or pathetic deviants. Or... In the end, it all added up to one thing. Sugi owed more than she took in. Those debts mounted. And now those debts belong to Jazz. She always told herself,
I'll never be like Aunt Sugi.
This job is a merciless one, and it requires rather extreme moral calisthenics. You go where the credits flow. You take the target out however you have to. She doesn't have to be friendly, but she damn sure has to be fast, and she has to be good. That's how you earn a name. That's how you get the next job. Even still, she tells herself that she's here because right now, the New Republic is the winning side. They don't have the whole galaxy pinned down and buttoned up all nice and neat yet, no, but the stars are drifting in that direction. One by one, systems shake free the yoke of the Empire's oppression and move to independence. And the chaos of that independence drives them inevitably to the New Republic. A single banner. One government. A new galactic order. Whatever. And if that breaks apart and falls away, as it could, then Jazz tells herself,
Now flip.
She can swing like a monkey lizard from a broken branch to a safe one. From the Republic back to the Empire. Or to a separatist system instead. Could be she'll tuck herself into the pocket of some credit-flush crime lord. Long as it's not the Hutts.
as Sugi never had luck with those treacherous piles of humid guano. Certainly there will be a number of ex-imperial bankers striking out on their own. They'll need enforcers. They'll need someone to go secure their loans, break some legs, twist some tentacles, blacken an eye or another sensory organ. She has always told herself, pragmatism above ideals, self above others, the mind over the heart, the job above all else. This is that, right? And yet, here she is, with a team. Ugh. Sinjir looks over, gives her a wink even as she tries to remind herself,
you're not here to make friends.
And across the table is Jom, who has this look in his eye, this hungry look, like he wants to reach across the table and gobble her right up. And may the stars help her. She feels a rising heat, and by all the gods of the great beyond, what happened to her? Is this who she really is? Soft, like Sugi? Maybe her aunt hides within her like a ghost, summoned to the flesh when she got soft. Or maybe Sugi knew something special all along, something Jazz is only just learning. She doesn't like it.
Burn it out with fire, she thinks.
Nora stands there. Nora, whom Jazz feels warmly toward, which makes her wonder suddenly if her brain has been taken by some kind of parasite, like that Nymoidian tick larva that makes you crave blood, and spreads out a special deck of Pazak cards. Jazz is thankful for the sudden distraction. These are not your standard cards. These are the New Republic's most wanted. On each, a face and a name, listing the Imperials the New Republic wants captured. Some of them are big players presently operating within the known empire. Others have gone AWOL, like Geddi. Speaking of Geddi, Nora grabs that card and hands it to her son.
Tim, if you would.
He nods and takes it over to a board hanging from the wall, next to the oxygen recycler. Temin takes a little blob of tacky goo from a can, dabs it to the back of the card, and sticks it up there, alongside nearly a dozen others. Among them, the targets from Akiva, Pandion, Tashu, Shale, Crassus, and those they've taken since, Commandant Strad, Prefect Kosh, Moffs Keong and Nile, Vice General Adambo, and ex-ISB Minister Van Eowelt. Nora says what Jazz already knows.
Geddi was poisoned, likely the poison hidden in his spice.
Jazz asks if it was the fungus, and Nora confirms.
As if there were any doubt,
Jazz thinks.
I know who did it,
Jazz says. Eyes turn toward her, expectantly.
A bounty hunter, like me. Mercurial Swift. He loves poisons. And that mycotoxin is one of his signature favorites.
Jom grunts. Though he saves half a moment to pin his gaze on her, he smiles. She tries not to smile back, and fails.
Damn it.
That means what?
He asks.
The Empire has sent killers after their own?
We don't know the Empire engineered the killing, Nora says.
But it makes sense, right?
Temin asks.
I mean, come on. Geddi left the Empire, and if we picked him up, maybe he'd flip on others.
Good,
Jom says.
That's easy, then. We suss out which ones are AWOL, and we concentrate on the others instead. Let the Empire eject its own garbage. Saves us the effort.
Robs us of the credits, too,
Jazz says, her brow knitted.
We're not doing this for the credits.
You're not doing this for the credits. Me, it's the only reason.
You don't care about the galaxy at all? Don't care about doing justice for the people? And kicking the Empire out the airlock?
She shrugs, even though inside that war between her two halves goes from a cold war to a very hot one.
No, I don't care. I care about the me who is on this adventure. And besides, if all of you cared so much about the people of the galaxy, why did our last job concentrate on taking out Gedi instead of Kanker? Gedi was just sitting there, high on spice, hurting mostly nobody. But Kanker runs a slave network. We didn't take him out. We didn't free any slaves. What good did we do?
We had orders, Burrell protests.
Spoken like a true Imperial,
Jazz snaps back. She's revving his engine now. She knows that. But past the sharp teeth of her sarcasm lies a real question. What good are they doing? The better question being, why does she care? Jom stands, his nostrils flaring. She's happy to have made him mad. It thrills her, inexplicably. She's tempted to drag him into the bunk room for another sparring match. But Nora suddenly raises her voice to say,
none of this is relevant right now. We can talk about the hows and whys of what we do later. Right now we've been asked, quietly, very quietly, to look into someone who has gone missing.
Who is it?
Jazz asks. Temin whistles.
I bet it's either Skywalker or Solo.
That earns him some looks, including a jaw-dropper from Nora. But Jazz can buy it. She says,
that tracks. Two heroes at the Battle of Endor, and I haven't seen Solo around here in months. Skywalker for even longer.
The look on Nora's face tells the tale true. It's one of those two. She pinches the bridge of her nose and nods.
Yes, Han Solo is missing.
General Solo, Burrell corrects.
And Nora corrects him in turn.
He resigned his commission.
He's just a smuggler, and not our concern.
I say he's our concern, Nora says. Besides, this comes from on high. From a source very high up in the New Republic.
Leia,
Jazz says.
That's Princess Leia to you,
Nora says.
And how did you know that? Did you bug my chambers?
No. I know because I'm a professional. And because Scuttlebutt says the two of them have been a thing since Endor or before. Makes sense that he goes missing, and she's the one who wants him found. Understandable she'd come to us. Smart credits say she's using Wedge as an intermediary.
I heard they got married, Temin says.
Wedge and Princess Leia?
Jom asks, incredulous.
Solo and Princess Leia.
Oh.
Sinjir claps his hands.
Bonus trivia. She's pregnant.
A chorus of retorts and refutations rise in response, but Sinjir crosses his arms and jeers at them.
What? Don't look at me like I'm some malfunctioning protocol droid spitting babble. Whatever your jobs are, mine is to read people like they're a menu at the local automat. The way she dresses, the way she carries herself, the rosy flush to her cheeks, her hands drifting unconsciously to her stomach. Pregnant.
That last word he says in a sing-songy way.
Pregnant.
Mr. Bones echoes, also singing, except his song is a disharmonic glitch ballad. Everyone winces.
Stop,
Sinjir tells the droid.
Roger, roger.
All of this is melodramatic and insignificant, Jazz thinks.
Do we have anything on Solo? Any leads at all?
We have one,
Nora answers.
Leia sent over the Falcon's movements. Solo was trying to single-handedly liberate Kashyyyk. But something went wrong, and his co-pilot, Chewbacca the Wookiee, went missing. We have a pattern representing his search.
Nora pulls up a holomap. It fills the air around them with orbs representing glittering systems, each linked by a shining, shimmering hyperspace route. Nora focuses in on a region near Wild Space.
He could be in one of a dozen systems.
It's a start,
Jom says. Sinjir thrusts a long, pointy finger down on the table. He hops it from card to card.
Maybe some of our erstwhile Imperial guests have some information. I'll canvass our captives.
I can check with some of my contacts in the underworld, Jazz says. If Solo's truly desperate, he may have been clumsy enough to have drawn attention to himself.
Good, Nora says. I'll dust off the moth and fly it out to where Chewbacca was taken by the Empire. Maybe if we can find a clue there as to where Solo's co-pilot ended up, it'll help us narrow down our options.
Jom nods.
Let's get to work, then.
They each know their job. Jazz heads out, willfully getting ahead of Jom to make sure that he and the rest of the crew know she's no heart-swollen star calf, no moon-eyed waif, no lust-struck fool. But again, that war of thoughts within her. Why do you care what they think? Aren't you protesting over much? Admit it.
Right now, you'd climb him like a ladder.
It makes her grouchy. Outside, Sinjir awaits to make her even grouchier. He's grinning big and broad, with the puckishness of a boy who hid his mother's credit purse.
What?
She asks, defensive.
You,
he says.
Me what?
You never once asked.
Never once asked what? Speak plainly, Sin, or I'll boot you off this platform. I'm in no mood for your brand of devilry.
What it paid.
I said speak plainly.
He rolls his eyes, obviously impatient with her lack of getting it.
You never asked what it would pay to go find the missing Solo, Jazz. You didn't ask about a bounty or a reward. Not any of it.
I...
Her breath catches in her chest. A very real and very cold panic rises inside her like a cyclone of sleet.
He's right. She didn't.
Worse, she didn't even give a thought to it.
I knew there'd be a reward,
she lies to him, and really to herself as well.
Leia's accounts run deep. Of course rescuing Solo would be a particularly big payout. And even if not, having an Alderaanian princess owe you a favor is not insignificant.
She tells herself that all these things are so true that she must have just taken them on as assumed. Of course it would be worth her while.
Look at you. Such precious backpedaling.
Eat slim, Rathvelius.
He chortles and winks. She stomps off.
I'm not here to make friends.
She repeats this in her head again and again, over and over, until it's all just gabbling noise. Chapter 10 Mos Amida is troubled. He has not slept in days. He has hardly eaten. He is a creature who is trapped by the architecture of a government he helped create. A government that no longer wants him or needs him. For a time, Amida hoped he had it figured out. He would give himself up. He would hand himself over to the New Republic, and they could do with him as they chose. It was, he believed, a foolproof plan. And it was a plan that left him eerily comforted. At least it felt like he had agency. At least it felt like the choice to give up was his, because everything else is out of his hands. Everything but minor administrative details. It is lonely being the head of a dying empire. He is a figurehead, or worse than one. They don't even trot him out for appearances. His office and his chambers make up his prison. It's here he mostly stays, taking in his meals, watching the HoloNet, thinking about his future, or rather the lack of his future. It wasn't supposed to be like this. Palpatine was supposed to remain. The Emperor was as certain a fixture in the galaxy as the core itself, as fundamental as the Imperial Palace, timeless and immortal. But he wasn't. He is dead. And Mos Amida is alive. Moss wishes he was dead, too. And that is his plan when he returns to his office in the tallest spire of the palace. The office has a balcony, over which one can regard the width and breadth of the Empire's throne room. It has a deflector shield, of course. The whole palace does. But that shield only stops energy blasts. It won't stop a physical being such as himself from passing through it. He will go to his office. He will step out onto the balcony, and he will jump. None will care. Why would they? The illusion of a united, cohesive galactic empire won't last much longer. Already the schisms have begun. It's breaking apart like a delicate pastry in his fingers.
"You're an administrator," Mon Mothma said. "So administrate."
The only thing he intends to administer tonight is his own demise. He steps into his office, distracted. It takes him a moment to notice the blue glow coming from the far side of the room, flickering before the massive, bulging window that overlooks the Federal District like a great eye. It's a holographic image. An unmoving one, a static image captured. Amida approaches the desk cautiously. There, in its center, an image reader. On it, a crystal. Amida stares at himself, because there he is, in that image, like a ghost of himself standing there with Palpatine and four others. Screed and Rancid he recognizes, and Yularen too. The final, though, just a boy. It takes him a moment to recognize.
"Do you remember it?"
comes a voice from the far corner of the room. He startles, though he tries not to show it. Amida turns, attempting to demonstrate his implacable demeanor. As his eyes adjust, he sees someone sitting there in the far lounger, leaning forward, hands clasped over his... no, her knees.
"Grand Admiral Sloane," he says.
She stands up. Here, before him, is the leader of one of those Imperial fragments, a rather considerable one, perhaps the fragment of note. She controls what remains of the Imperial Navy, and their Navy is dominant, so it is clear that whoever controls the Navy controls the Empire. More or less. Still, it leaves her without the bulk of the ground forces, but rumor already has it that she's begun to bridge that gap and complete the deficit in her military presence. Another rumor is that she's been cleaning house. Those who are not faithful to the Navy find themselves at the wrong end of a blaster. That's what this is, he realizes. She's come to kill him. And here, an ironic twist, because now Amida is thinking,
I could kill her first.
He has a blaster holstered under the desk. If he could just skirt around, he could get it. He could defeat her before she defeats him. What a coup that would be, rather than the coup she intends it to be. He begins to back toward his desk even as she advances.
That image, she says, that is you in it.
Obviously.
He's at the edge of his desk now. His nails tick and tack against its hard metal surface even as he slides around the edge. Now the holographic image separates him from her. Her image is warped by the hologram, stretched and mutilated, at least until he eases around to his chair and begins to sit.
Let me take a seat, and we can talk.
Yes, let's talk.
His hand eases to his knee, then in toward the blaster.
Why do you bring me this image?
He asks.
I want to know about it.
I can't imagine why it interests you. It's archival, meaningless.
His finger teases along the edge of the holster, and he realizes he's leaning into it too far. His movement is surely telegraphed. She's no fool. She'll see what he's doing.
You have to move fast.
And he does. He reaches in.
And finds no blaster. I have your weapon, she says.
She pulls it from behind her, letting it dangle like a tantalizing piece of fruit hanging from a branch too high to reach.
I'm not here to have a conversation with blasters. I'm here to have a conversation between two equals.
That last bit, she says, like she doesn't believe it, though Amida supposes he appreciates the thought just the same. Resigned, he sighs and eases back into his chair. He slouches.
Fine. I don't know what help I could possibly give you.
It's the boy in that picture. Who is he?
I don't know.
She can tell he's lying, can't she?
You know something?
Haven't you heard? I know nothing.
She leans in, hands planted on the desk.
I have had a hard night, so spare me your appetite for self-pity.
He notes suddenly that she does look rough. She's not even wearing her uniform. Sloane appears in the guise of a common pilot.
What fresh mystery is this? Tell me something.
Amida chews on it.
Why help her?
She holds his fate in her hands. Mon Mothma's words revisit him.
So, administrate.
If he wants to bring the Empire back into his grip, then maybe this is the way. An alliance with her. Or at least a favor done, which means a favor owed. He hems and haws as he thinks.
I remember something. He would send his ship out, always with proxies, droids or advisors, or once upon a time, his inquisitors. One time the ship returned with a stowaway. It was that boy, I believe. The one in the picture.
And who is that boy?
You already know who.
Gallius Rax.
A strange tremble presents itself in his many stomachs. An acid tingle, eager and excited, despite the insanity of it. Since the destruction of the second Death Star, rumor has dogged every step of the Empire and come at him from every angle. Nearly all of these rumors could be discarded. Vader was surely not alive, despite what some insisted. Nor could Palpatine be giving commands after his death through coded droid messengers. How absurd a story was that? But one of them was that Rax had survived and was manning the Ravager, the Empire's last super star destroyer. Then the truth came out that he was dead and Sloane had control.
He's not dead,
Amida whispers. Sloane says nothing.
Where did Rax come from?
But he doesn't answer that. Instead, he says,
if he's not dead, are you really in control, Admiral Sloane?
She points his own blaster toward him.
I'm in control of this conversation. Of that, you must be assured.
Yes, of course.
He swallows hard. This is an opportunity. For a long time, he felt himself sliding down the side of a mountain. A slow and unending slip down the scree.
But here is a handhold.
He doesn't understand it. He cannot say where it will take him should he avail himself of it.
This isn't hope, not yet, but it's close.
I don't know where Rax came from, but I know how you could find out.
Tell me.
Those droids I spoke of. They might know the boy that Rax once was. Their memory banks might have data. If not the droids, then the data banks of the ship itself. The Imperialis.
A slicer could access the data in those droids, she says. If I knew where they were.
I know where they are.
A cold silence stretches out between them. Finally, she says,
tell me where.
And what will I get?
You will get not shot.
Hardly good enough,
he says.
My lust for life is a dead and withered thing, Admiral Sloane. I am a broken fixture on the wall of an empty palace. If you want my help, I want a place in your empire. If it is your empire, well, is it?
She narrows her eyes, suspicious of him, as she should be.
It is, or will be. I can give you a place. You know how to run an empire, after all.
Yes,
he thinks.
I know how to run one, even if I don't know how to leave one. Rax is still alive, isn't he? You don't have to answer. I see the fear in your eyes. You're a prisoner of your own command. Just like me. Perhaps we can plot our escape together. Perhaps we can take over the prison.
He idly drags a nail against his teeth. Click, click, click.
The droids are in storage, along with the wreckage of the Imperialis itself.
Where?
Where else? Quan Chi, the junk moon of Ord Mantell.
Part 2. Interlude. The Alderaan Flotilla.
Asteroids tumble through space. They drift and spiral. And when one hits the perimeter shield, it breaks. Bits drift, pulverized, as the rest of the rock pirouettes away to join the rest of its crumbling brethren. Every time it happens, it hurts Tevin Gale's heart. Because that asteroid is a piece of his world. Was a piece of his world, anyway. Out there waits an infinite black space horizon of Alderaan, now reduced to rock. The flotilla is safe, at least. 7 ships belong to the flotilla now, including the Alderaanian frigate Sunspire. Another gift from the nascent Republic. Or rather, another gift from their princess. The ships float near to one another, gathering in a circle and protected by the deflector shield to keep out both the asteroids and, hopefully, marauders.
The galaxy is drifting toward lawlessness, he thinks.
Better that, though, than choked in the black steel gauntlet of Darth Vader. Out in the black, demo droids drill and dig into the asteroids, one by one. They look like fireflies out there, with their bright orange light flickering from their cutting lasers. Those droids look for anything of note from the world the Alderaanians lost. Artifacts, remains, fragments of precious stones or minerals or metals. Even a single brick would be a find. Accessing any of this wasn't even an option under Imperial rule. The Empire blockaded all access to the Alderaanian graveyard. Behind him, the argument, the one he tries to tune out, continues. Eaglin Valmore is up and pacing, as is her wont.
This is our home. This patch of sky is ours. Our world was here. And the diaspora has returned us to this place. We are home, and I will not leave it.
She tugs on the loose braid from her ice-blonde hair. She's young, Gale thinks, unlike himself. But she's got a vital heart. He likes her. She and the others are not royals. There exists only one of those now. But they are what the world has left. Alderaan has to be ruled by someone, and the commoners are what remains. Valmore is not queen, but rather regent administrator.
Bah!
Says Ikar Orlis, once a teacher at a university. The man sits back in his chair, idly scratching at the peaky beard rising up off his jowls like mountains of chef's meringue.
This is no world, regent administrator. Forgive me for saying, it's just rock. Blasted, wretched rock. The Empire turned our world into salt and dust. And though I'm old, I, for one, don't want to be like some geriatric clutching to his chest the remnants of what once was. It's time to demand resettlement. I've prepared a list of worlds we could colonize.
That's not how it works, chimes in Argus Tanzer.
Argus is a young bureaucrat, possessing a handsomeness that looks less cultivated and more like someone simply carved him out of quartzine.
Argus thrusts up a finger, gesturing with it as he speaks. The New Republic won't be keen on us just picking some planet and resettling there.
There's a process.
He lowers his voice when he adds, not that anyone quite knows what the process is. Orlis barks.
All the more reason to seize the chance now. We can claim that the Republic simply did not have their bows tied and they're not cinched. We seize upon their ignorance.
Besides,
adds Janus Pole, an elder diplomat, a small woman as sharp and as pale as a broken tooth. She steeples her fingers and stares over them.
We are not yet members of the Republic. We are,
says Ryena Tor. She's young, too young to be here, Gale thinks. But when the Empire destroyed their world, what was left but those who were living off-world? Ryena was with her missionary parents, part of a roving school dedicated to helping those in the galaxy who could not so easily help themselves. Now she's back and fulfilling a similar mission, isn't she?
We can't help ourselves,
Tevin thinks. He reminds himself,
we're all just asteroids tumbling into one another.
Ryena continues, visibly nervous as she says,
we are a member of the New Republic. Leia is one of the most vital members.
And yet we have no senator,
Orlis says.
We've no representation. We've no vote. What has Leia given us? Is she even truly our princess? None of us are royals. Why do we think she would listen to us?
It's time to speak up. Gale turns and offers words in a stern tone when he says, Leia has already listened to us. She's given us this flotilla. Four of these ships are from her. The supplies we use to survive are from her. We exist gathered together because of the efforts of her and Yvonne Verlaine and the other Alderaanians working on Chandrilla. I'll not have her name sullied in this room.
That earns murmurs and mumbles of both agreement and dissent. He hopes the dissenters will change their tune soon enough. As if on cue, in the center of the Korobite table, a table carved from one of the asteroids and formed of Alderaanian bedrock and schist, lights up with an incoming message. Above the table floats Rickert Beagle, one of the comm officers on the Sunspire.
We have incoming ships, he says, visibly worried.
Who is it?
The Regent Administrator asks, leaning in.
We don't know, but the ships are big.
They damn well should be,
Tevin thinks. Hauling cargo that big, well, you just can't pull it along with a couple of tug-tugs. The worry rises in the room, whispers of pirates or bandits, fear of a resurgent empire, or perhaps worse, some brutal fragment of what remains of the empire. Certainly rumors have persisted of various worrisome remnants of the Imperial forces that have gone mad out there in space. Rickert suddenly says,
wait, we have a signature. Code clearance says it's New Republic.
Beyond the asteroid field, ships begin to pop out of hyperspace. Big ships. Cargo freighters whose cargo will not fit within those ships' bellies. Cargo so big, it must in fact be contained in its own shield, lashed to the ships with magna beams. The scrap they haul is epic in size. Huge, curved slices like the rind of some fruit designed only for the massive hand of an old god. Those with Tevin gather at the glass, staring out.
What am I looking at?
Valmore asks.
It is a gift from our princess, I had to pull quite a few strings just to get this on the table. But as it turns out, nobody was really doing anything with it. It was just going to end up as scrap elsewhere. I started the ball rolling, but it was Leia who really made it happen. Her and Yvonne. Orlis growls.
I still don't know what that is or why we'd want it.
But Tanzer sees it. He smirks.
It's pieces of that damnable Death Star, isn't it?
It is. It is. Tevin laughs and nods. They reduced us to scrap. Now we get their scrap as reparations for war. This is just the first lot of it, too. Quite a bit more coming if we say the word.
We could build a whole space station of our own, the Regent Administrator says, beaming.
She presses her hands against the glass, and therein lies the wonderment of a child, even though she is one no longer.
That's my hope, Tevin says. What say the rest of you? Orlis grumbles some kind of reluctant acquiescence, then stomps off.
Pole, another dissenter, shrugs.
We can try this, but resettlement will still be on the table. And we must be afforded a voice in the Senate if we are to aid the New Republic in any of its efforts to secure the galaxy.
Their conversation fades as Tevin looks at the Regent Administrator. An untested, untrained, politically naive young woman whose eyes are as big as moons and whose heart is as bright as 10 suns. The awe in her eyes is so tangible, Tevin thinks he could bask in it, drink it up even.
This is our future,
she says, not to him, not to any of them, but to the glass and to the space beyond.
Yes, he thinks. I hope it is.
Chapter 11. The moth drops out of hyperspace into the open black of nowhere. For a moment, Nora finds the open emptiness overwhelming, as if it's going to swallow her whole. Once upon a time, she found the expanse of space comforting. So much potential, so much freedom. These days, it only offers her terror, from which she must wrest her own respite. She tries Leia's trick, closing her eyes, drawing a deep breath, exhaling slowly. Nora tries to reclaim that feeling of freedom, and finding even that difficult, she just lets herself sit there. In, out. Clear the mind. Become one with the stars. And then, it helps. She feels less lost, less overwhelmed, more centered.
Thanks, Leia.
She cuts the engines, and the ship floats there. The moth once belonged to the smuggler, Huerto Neucho. But he lost his life during the rebellion on Akiva after helping Nora get planetside. That left the MK-4 freighter up for grabs. Nora considered selling it. But truth is, how long can she live this life? She was a pilot for the Rebel Alliance and now leads a team of Imperial hunters for the New Republic. This work has to have an expiration date, she tells herself. And yet, she keeps coming back for job after job. Either way, it seemed like a good idea to have a ship of her own for once. Something that belonged to the Wexley name. If she dies, or when, since immortality is not likely, then Temin will have something to call his own. He is becoming a good pilot. He deserves it. Especially since his father is gone. He should have something of his own. Right now, though, Temin isn't here. Though she's not alone, either.
See anything?
Wedge asks, hobbling into the cockpit. Nora points at the viewscreen.
Out there, in the foreground of the glittering stars, float bits of gleaming metal.
Wreckage. Giving her a little thrust, Nora says. And she does. The moth eases forward.
Wedge leans over her, accidentally bumping into her. They share an awkward laugh as he clears his throat and sets up the scanner. After a few key taps, a green beam, glittering like precious stones, flung onto a cloth of black velvet, sweeps the void in front of them. First a vertical scan, then horizontal, pulsing as it searches and catalogs. This space represents the coordinates of the Millennium Falcon, when Solo and Chewie were trapped by the Empire. The Falcon wasn't destroyed here, was it? There's a lot of debris, Nora asks.
I doubt it, Wedge says. Leia didn't say as much. Besides, the Falcon has gotten out of more scrapes than the galaxy has stars, I think.
Nora can personally attest to that. She remembers watching the blue burn of the freighter's engines as it whipped through the narrow channels and conduits inside the belly of the second Death Star. The ship clipped a pipe and lost its retina array, the dish spinning off as Nora's Y-wing went past. Wedge goes on to say,
"Something sure happened out here. Look at this."
Data scrolls on the nav screens.
Wreckage from at least 4 different ships. None of them the Falcon. Let's see what we have. 3 freighters, 1 fighter. Wait, Imperial wreckage too. Scrap from a TIE Wings panel. What a mess. I don't know that we're going to find any clues to Chewie's whereabouts out here, Nora.
Let's pull in the scrap. See if we can't eyeball something.
I'll get the tractor beam cooking, he says.
Wedge eases into the co-pilot's chair. As he spins up the beam controls, he looks over at Nora.
Thanks for having me along. It's nice being out in the black again. Planetside's all right, but out here, this is home.
It won't be long before you're back in action.
I hope so.
He hesitates. He looks like he wants to say something.
What is it?
After this, after we find Han, because I know we will, do you want to,
he coughs into his hand and wets his lips.
You want to go out and get a drink sometime? I know this little cliffside cantina.
Movement on the view screen.
They both see it.
Nora says,
did you see that?
Something darts from one piece of scrap to another. It moves like a squid through water, tentacles pushing off, legs like a blooming flower whose petals are closing. There's a red glow before the shadowy shape is again behind another piece of scrap, hiding there, where the sensor beam wouldn't have found it. Wedge says,
let's see what we've got.
The tractor beam hums as it fires up.
I'm not your babysitter, Singier says.
Good, because I'm not a baby.
Temin and Singier head down the hall toward a door guarded by 2 New Republic soldiers with vibro-staves crossing the door.
I never said you were a baby.
Good, because I'm not.
Before they get to the door, Singier stops and plants a hand on Temin's chest.
Listen, the pouty, angry teenage thing, it's tiring.
I know. Does that mean you're going to stop doing it?
Temin asks, crossing his arms and cocking his eyebrows. The smirk that crosses Singier's face will not be denied.
You think you're clever, do you? He sighs.
At least the boy told that mad droid of his to stay home when asked.
Believe me, I speak from experience when I say that cleverness will earn you as many enemies as it does friends. So, take it down a notch. We've got work to do. It's just...
But then the boy shuts up. Singier knows he's going to regret this in much the same way one might regret sticking a hand into a hive of red jacket wasps in the hope that they make honey. Hint, they don't. But he asks anyway.
Oh, fine. What is it?
I don't know what I'm doing here.
We're here to visit one of our estimable prisoners.
No, I mean like here. Like,
The boy makes a wild, frenetic gesticulation. That sound, that movement, perfectly articulates a specific feeling. That's when Sinjir understands the problem.
Ah, the existential here. I don't know what that means. It means you're having a crisis of identity.
Temin fidgets.
Yeah, I guess.
Congrats, my boy. It means you become a proper adult.
So you don't have it figured out?
Hardly. I'm utterly bewildered 9 times out of 10. I just happen to make it look good. I don't know what I'm doing here either. I suspect that the moment I have it figured out, I'll probably die 1/2 a second later. Because if there's one mystical energy that powers the galaxy, it's not the Force. It's pure, unadulterated irony. Now, let's go talk to General Shale. See if she can't help us in our foolhardy quest to locate the errant smuggler.
I hate this place,
Jom says, following Jazz through a narrow, crooked alley on Nar Shaddaa. Behind them is the mouth of one of the moon's countless black markets. This one is lorded over by the maven Nyarla the Hutt, a slime-dripping slug woman whose red tongue slathered the nozzle of a bubbling spice drip while she told them she didn't know a damn thing about Solo, his Wookiee, or Imperial prisons out in wild space.
You want to hang with me?
Jazz says.
You should get used to places like this, Burrell.
At that, Jom feels mighty conflicted. He does want to hang with Jazz. His attraction to her is something on a whole other level. It's practically feral. His greatest desire right now is to grab her and pull her into some dark alcove and have another go. And yet, why? She's nothing like him. He's a man of order and principle. She's a fragging bounty hunter of all things. A criminal haven like this is second nature to her. Meanwhile, he feels like a Mon Cala out of water. Like he's drowning in open air, totally exposed.
This is a strange place for a date, he says.
You're funny. It's not a date. Don't think that what we had will happen again. It was just a bit of fun, is all.
They pass a stall full of wide-mouthed, toothy aliens, barking about a table full of strange oils and unguents. He slaps their hands away as they reach for him, and he calls after Jazz.
No reason the fun has to end.
Fun always has to end, Burrell.
They push on toward the spaceport. Really, it's just a ship receptacle carved out of the urban sprawl. Jazz paid some crumple-headed weequay too many credits to keep their ship hidden and off syndicate registers. She told Jom that Black Sun operates out here, and the last thing she wants is to be on their screens. Them or the Crimora.
I have debts,
she told him. He asked her what kind, but she didn't elucidate. As they duck under a ratty tapestry hanging from a fraying rope and enter the spaceport, Jom says,
This is the 3rd time we've come up empty, Amari. Maybe it's time to realize that your underworld connections here are drying up. Time to go back to Chandrilla, and...
The air warbles, and something hits Jom in the back, knocking the air out of him. He pitches forward, chin hitting the ground and teeth biting into his tongue. Blood fills his mouth as he tries to summon his limbs to move, but they don't respond to his commands.
I've been stunned.
He barely manages the will to lift his chin off the dirty ground, and he sees Jazz pinned down by a series of red lights. Beam sights, he realizes. Dozens of them. All from weapons threatening to fire. Her hands are up in surrender as enemies close in from the shadows.
Frag!
The airlock shudders as the moth's oxygen cyclers pump air into it. Wedge steps forward, leaning hard on his cane. He and Nora share a look. Then she jams the big red button with the heel of her hand. The door slides open with a rattling bang. There, inside, sit heaps of scrap drawn into the ship with the tractor beam. Already she sees plasma scoring and char marks. What she doesn't see is anything moving. "I know I saw something out there," she says.
Wedge nods. "We both saw it."
Just then, a piece of hull scrap shifts, groaning against the floor. Then all is silent once more. The two of them draw their blasters. A faint scuttling and scraping. And again, nothing. Moments pass. Wedge starts to say,
"Maybe together we could lift..."
The scrap piece flips up suddenly, slamming against the wall with a deafening bang. A dark shape, big as an astromech, takes flight, slamming into Wedge. He screams as he falls.
"The tea here, right?"
Sidgir says, holding up his steaming cup as if to demonstrate. He takes a noisy sip, while Temin stares disappointedly down at his own cup.
"It's a far sight better than what we got at Imperial Commissary, that's for certain."
Jilia Shale was once a general in the Empire's army, and legendarily one hell of a strategist. Sadly, her legend was habitually ignored by those above her. She sits with both of her small hands around a cup of her own.
"It is something, but I had my own supply during the Empire days."
The apartment is spare, but functional. It's more than she'd get in a prison cell. She has a food prep station instead of a protein recycler, a proper bathroom instead of a vacuum-suck porthole, and no interrogator droids hovering about. All because she has played along and given the New Republic true answers to the questions it has posed.
"House arrest's quite nice," Sinjir thinks. "I should have gotten arrested."
He could live a comfortable life in one of these boxes, as long as they delivered liquor.
Did they?
He makes a mental note to ask. Then he sets the tea down, because tea is disgusting.
"So, nothing?"
he asks, rapping his knuckles gently on the low table between them. He gestures toward the star map hovering there holographically.
"You don't know anything about this base? We're looking for Imperials. Any at all you think might be in that area?"
If no answers present themselves, that means Solo is what? Investigating that region of his own daft giggles? Perhaps he's truly gone back to the smuggler life, succumbed to the pressure of adult life, and bailed on the wife and the coming child. Perhaps Solo kissed the straight and narrow goodbye, and he's gone off to have his own illicit adventures. It's what Sinjir would do. It's what Sinjir did, at least. Still, Shale is lying. He can tell she's withholding. It's strange sitting here, interrogating someone of Shale's stature. Though he supposes her stature has fallen considerably. Not in his mind, though. Interrogating her, and that's what this is, just a more polite version of it, makes him feel rather uncomfortable. He tries not to show it, though.
"Do you miss it?"
Shale suddenly asks.
"What's that?" "The warm embrace of the Empire."
"Ah, an embrace as warm as a hug from a slab corpse."
He taps his thumbnail against the side of the teacup.
Tink, tink, tink. "No, I don't miss it. I don't miss who I was or what I did in its service. I miss who I was once before the Empire turned me into me. Not that I much remember that version of myself, but I'm quite confident he existed. He may have even been nice."
"I don't miss it either. What we did formed a scar across this galaxy, and I'm not sure it will ever truly fade."
She sighs.
"You should go ask Tashu. I don't know anything, but he and his other sycophant advisors seemed awfully enamored of that region." Good luck finding whatever it is you seek, Loyalty Officer Rathvelis.
And with that, they are dismissed.
Wedge squirms and kicks under the clicking limbs of an Imperial probe droid. Not a Viper, but one of the smaller Prowler models. The droid's flat, disc-shaped body suddenly glows red around the margins and emits a high-pitched trill. Nora recoils from the sound, her ears ringing. It's a noise so terrible it feels like it's trying to bore into her skull. All she can do is steady her hand, take aim, and... Her blaster shot slams the probe droid back, sending its top popping off. Its spider legs, free from the body, come away in Wedge's hands, and he flings them to the ground before kicking them away with his one good leg. His hair is a mess. His cheek is bleeding. Nora rushes over, grabs a kerchief from her pocket, and dabs at it. "Hold still," she tells him. Thankfully, it's not serious. Just a scrape from one of the thing's limbs.
The droid sits in the corner, sparking and smoking. The red light shines bright one last time, then goes dark. At least the sound is gone. What was that sound? Self-defense mechanism? The two of them are left sitting and staring at it.
"Why is there a probe droid out here?"
he asks, panting. She helps him stand.
"Searching the wreckage like we were?"
Could be. But why remain out here? That's a Prowler probe. They don't travel long distances. They're local.
"They forgot it?" she posits. "It's easy enough to leave behind, especially if things got violent."
"That doesn't sound like the Empire."
"Maybe not the old one, but in its current state, they're different now, less efficient."
Her brow wrinkles.
"Hey, those probes don't travel far, but how's their transmission range? Could it have been..."
Wedge grabs his cane and uses it to move toward the droid. With the toe of his boot, he lifts it. Sure enough, on the underside is a modular comm array. A little transceiver dish that would have been hidden by its limbs. That dish is blinking green.
"It's still transmitting," Nora says.
"What could they possibly be?"
From the cockpit, a proximity alarm. Its presence could mean only one thing. Incoming ships! Nora rushes out of the hold and into the cockpit, spinning the chair and plonking herself down just in time to see a Star Destroyer cut through space like a spear tip.
Drool drips from Jom's chin as he grunts, pushing himself up on shaky arms. Ugh. He falls back down, pain radiating through his old shoulder injury. With one hand, he fumbles gamely for the blaster rifle, hanging on his back. But the toe of a boot pries his hand away and gently steps on it. It's Jazz's boot.
Her hands are still up. She looks down at him and shakes her head, clucking her tongue.
"No, no. Stay still."
"Jazz,"
he moans.
"Shh."
And with that, they are surrounded. Ridge-browed Nyctos emerge, hand cannons held aloft, beam sights all targeting Jazz. Their nose slits flare, as if sniffing for her scent. Blunt-toothed mouths gnash and clamp open air. They ease apart as a new player enters the scene. A woman, by the look of her. Face hidden behind a rust-pocked metal mask. The mask is curved, and the top of the metal is curled into the facsimile of curved horns. A pair of trillium lenses whir and buzz as they focus in on Jazz. The woman tilts her head and says,
"Hello, Imari."
"Under Boss Vinskar,"
Jazz says.
"Been a while."
"That's because you've been avoiding me. Playing Susie Good Girl with the New Republic, I hear."
"Job's a job, and last I checked, I needed credits."
The masked woman stiffens.
You do. To pay me. You have debts.
My aunt had debts.
And now they're yours.
Rinsgard barks, suddenly furious.
But since you don't seem to be able to pay, I have little choice here but to bring your head back to Boss Guilty. Black Sun demands money or blood, bounty hunter. Will it be blood? There is a bounty on your head.
Jom thinks.
I won't let this happen.
He again starts to lift himself up, but Jazz slams her foot down on his back. She hisses at him.
Stop! They'll kill you and kill me. And then what? I'll handle it.
Then to Rinsgar.
Who sold me out? It was the hut, wasn't it?
The huts are in disarray. Nyala has come back to Black Sun.
I will pay you what I owe.
We've all heard that one before.
I'll make you a deal.
Rinsgar sniffs behind the mask. The Nyctos gathered all share looks and laugh.
What deal could you make me?
I'll pay you twice what I owe. And failing that, I'll turn myself in. And the group I work with.
She'd really betray us?
He again starts to get up, protesting, and she grinds her heel against the back of his neck.
Interesting.
Rinsgar hisses. Her head tilts at a curious angle.
And all I have to do is let you scamper away out of my grip?
Actually,
Jazz says, offering a nervous laugh.
There's one more thing. I need information.
Don't we all?
The underboss hesitates.
What is it?
I need to locate someone. The smuggler, Han Solo.
Imperial advisor Yup Tashu was, is, and forever will be a wild-eyed religious zealot. His capture on Akiva did little to dampen his fervor, and in fact, seems to have allowed it to further infect his mind. That presents Sinjir with two problems. First, Tashu's devotion to the Empire, or more particularly, to Palpatine himself, is so intense it utterly overwhelms his fragile sense of self-interest. Second, he's as mad as a spark-drunk Minok. It's very hard to interrogate one who suffers from one of these problems, much less both of them. The deranged only offer cryptic or nonsense answers, while the self-sacrificial will gladly immolate themselves in the service of keeping their trap shut. Sinjir hasn't gotten anywhere with Tashu since they brought him in, and by the look of his cell, things have only gotten worse. The man stands there behind the buzzing laser shield. He paces the cage like a pilgrim who has lost his way, wandering the world with a vague sense of purpose and faith, but no actual destination. The walls have been marked up in his food waste. Strange symbols and maps and other indecipherable gibberish are drawn there. Temin stares. Sinjir sees that this is upsetting the boy. That's interesting. Something about Tashu has gotten to him. It's cracked the boy's veneer of false confidence.
I don't think I can do this,
Temin says.
You don't have to,
Sinjir says. Run along.
But
Temin, it's okay. Go. The boy cannot seem to tear his gaze away, so Sinjir helps him by turning the boy in the other direction and urging him forth with a gentle push. It's enough. Temin leaves. The only other one that's left now is the guard, a Chandrillan man with a swoop of blonde hair and a light scar along his chin.
Is Tashu usually like this?
Sinjir asks. The guard regards Sinjir with cold gray eyes, then reluctantly offers a curt nod. There's discomfort there with the guard,
and Sinjir is left to wonder why. Maybe the guard doesn't trust him. That's fine. He shouldn't.
Open the cage.
You have your orders, do you not?
But still, the guard hesitates. And there, Sinjir realizes, is the glorious yet naive failing of the New Republic. It isn't a fully fledged government. It isn't a proper military. In the Empire, you didn't turn down an order. You didn't hesitate. Hesitation meant reprimand. Failure meant Vader making 3 long strides into your office and pinching your windpipe shut with the power of his mind. In the Empire, the chain of command was everything. Someone above you told you to drop your pants and spin around 3 times? You did it. You didn't ask questions. Here, though, individuality rules the roost. That was, at least on paper, a benefit, right? You get to think your own thoughts, do your own good. If something doesn't sound right or smell right, you speak up. But when that happens, order breaks down. The saying might be too many admirals, not enough ensigns, but here that's not precisely true. Because in the New Republic, there aren't enough admirals either. And given that Mon Mothma has already begun trying to figure out how to demilitarize the galaxy, how long before it falls apart? Before it spins off its axis and bounces away? It wouldn't take much. The Empire couldn't even keep it together. And in that gap, the disease known as the Rebel Alliance formed. A disease that is presently killing its host. How long before the New Republic suffers the same gap? How long before the Empire returns the attack with its own infection? The Empire pushed too hard. But maybe the New Republic isn't pushing hard enough. Ugh, he needs a drink. Sinjir lends a John Burrell growl to his voice and says,
"You open that cage, guardsman, or I open your head."
"Fine," the guard says, staring balefully. He opens the cell.
"Thank you,"
Sinjir says, then steps inside. He tells the guard to turn the shield back on, which the man does, if reluctantly. Gently, Sinjir folds his hands behind his back. Best to give the veneer of authority here. Stand like an officer, and maybe, just maybe, Tashu will fall into an old pattern. He'll conjure the sense memory of what it was to serve in Palpatine's empire, and he'll nod and smile, bow and scrape, and give